is really two parts. One, the general idea that you really can use your mind to change your brain to benefit your mind and therefore all beings. That's numero uno. And then numero dos in our major themes is to apply that, what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity or self-directed neuroplasticity, plasticity being the capacity of the brain to change, it, literally its structure, based on learning, for better or worse. Well, the second major theme here for us is to apply that capacity to use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind, to one of the very fundamental pillars of practice in Buddhism, one of the three fundamental pillars of practice, which has to do with steadiness of attention. Because as Rick will talk momentarily about, attention is like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. It illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks it into your brain, for better or worse. And most of us don't have very good control over that vacuum cleaner. Plus, we live in a kind of ADD-ish sort of culture. So getting control over the vacuum cleaner, in other words, getting control over attention and steadying it, is very, very fundamental to practice. We're going to apply the general principles of self-directed neuroplasticity to this very important aspect of personal growth, everyday functioning, and certainly spiritual realization. So these topics here, honestly, we'll flow through them fairly easily and painlessly, I hope. The program here does cover a fair amount of ground. Our intention is to clear space as much as possible for experiential practice, internal practice. That's very important. So, alas, we'll tend to circumscribe discussion from time to time, even though this material really invites discussion. But we want to buy time for practice, so we'll do that. Also, if you want the slides, we're very happy to send them to you, and all we need is your name and email address, which we promise we'll never share with anyone else. And if you give us your name and email address, in addition to getting the slides for this workshop, we will automatically subscribe you, unless you say just slides, which is fine, to both the Wise Brain Bulletin, which is put out six times a year from the Institute Rick and I founded, as well as subscribe you to this little practice newsletter I send out called Just One Thing. It goes out weekly. It's very short, hopefully sweet, about practices. The one that just went out was called Feed the Wolf of Love, which has to do with the two wolves in the heart, one of love, one of hate, metaphorically speaking. Anyway, so that will happen, and if you're already getting those, it's okay. You won't be double subscribed, and so just let us know if you want the slides. And the larger point about that is you can kind of relax, you know what I mean? You don't need to remember any of this stuff. There won't be a test. Really, what you take away in your heart is what's going to make the most difference for you. Okay. So Rick and I will bounce back and forth. Oh, there we go. Sorry, these are the topics. I don't know what's going on with my slides bouncing back and forth here. Anyway, so Rick's going to take it away from here.
Okay. So we'll start. Neurology of the of awakening starts essentially with forming the idea of concentration. The dharmic history of this in the 2,500-year Buddhist tradition begins. The concentration is one of the three main pillars of practice. It's essentially one of the three main legs of the stool on which you sit, even though those are four-legged chairs. The first one of virtue, sila, expressing natural goodness, restraining what's harmful to oneself and others. It's hard to attain enlightenment. It's hard to become awakening, as Jack Kornfield said, when one has been out raping and pillaging all day. Concentration or samadhi. The terms that in the Western understanding of this mindfulness, steadiness of mind, meditative absorption. There's all three different flavors of the idea of concentration. And wisdom or panya, the Sanskrit word, of insight, understanding the Four Noble Truths, not just from a cognitive sense, but from a real whole body, embodied, and spiritual sense of awareness of what the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism actually might mean to your life. The three pillars of practice result in a path of practice in which one, by concentration, by that focused spotlight vacuum cleaner, both uncovers the true nature that is already present and purifies and transforms the mind and heart. Basically, by paying attention, one learns things about one's thoughts or being or actions that you might not have originally considered when you were performing those actions in a reflexive way. And finally, the path itself of concentration is its own reward and ultimately culminates in enlightenment and complete freedom from suffering. So there's some distinctions we'll make. You know, there are a lot of words that we throw around. For us, these are sort of the definitions we'll use. Awareness. Awareness is in the field in which neural activity, mysteriously or chaotically, as I like to think about it, becomes conscious experience. And awareness is moment by moment by moment. Attention is a heightened focus. It's the spotlight on a particular content of awareness, coming back to, really looking at, returning to that object that showed up in object of thought or of experience that showed up in your brain. Mindfulness is sustained attentiveness, typically with not only being aware of something, but being aware of being aware. So it's both in the process of paying attention and back behind that, looking at yourself paying attention. It's this little bit of mental jujitsu. And then concentration is a very deep absorption in the object of attention, sometimes to the point of non-ordinary states of consciousness. So in other words, becoming so absorbed in what you are thinking about that everything else begins to drop away. And the normal things of paying attention to sounds in the room and to other experiences and to memories of what's past disappear, and one becomes fully absorbed in what one is paying attention to. The importance of concentration. Today we're going to... There's a quick exam. You had to concentrate to get that slide. We're going to focus on one aspect of one pillar, which is the meditative depth. Okay, we're going to assume that nobody's been out raping and pillaging, so we're going to assume that people come in with morality. Wisdom we're going to leave up to the collective awareness to bring to the room in and of itself, and we'll focus on concentration. That aspect of meditative concentration has often been underemphasized as Buddhism came to the West. It's only been, I think, in the last 20 years that people have really begun to understand that concentration practice is, for many people, the door in. Strong concentration was recommended by the Buddha in innumerable passages, in innumerable suttas, as in, come back to this, come back to this, come back to this. It brings heft to the insight. It strengthens the will. It purifies the mind. It does all those lovely little moral things, which is kind of cool. And the Noble Eightfold Path in Buddhism includes wise concentration, which is the four jhanas, which are profound states of meditative absorption. And there we're talking about the four jhanas of being the mundane jhanas that are attainable fairly easily with practice by ordinary individuals, not the super mundane jhanas, which is a whole other retreat with some very good teachers who can take you down that road. We're not going to be teaching the jhanas, but how to nourish the brain in states that support the mental factors of jhana. So, if it's okay, I'll just go ahead and read this about concentration. And what, friends, is right concentration? Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a person enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, the person enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. With the fading away as well of rapture, the person abides in equanimity, and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he or she has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, he or she enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which is neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This is called right concentration. So all the way at the bottom of this entire sequence of things is right concentration, with neither pleasure nor pain. That's actually one concept. No pleasure, no pain. But actually a state of being alive and aware, and purity of mindfulness and equanimity. Equanimity is a profound, basic building block to awareness, awakening, and enlightenment as a state. So the factors that come up in this, if you go to applied attention to sustained attention. So we're going to translate those from the applied attention in the Buddhist statements to sort of a more Western idea of what this might represent. Applied attention, bringing it to bear. Rick has used a lot of the idea of the ice skater gliding across the ice. The blade of the boot is applied to the ice. So it's brought to bear on the ice to carry the person across. Sustained attention, staying with the target. The skater glides on that edge for as long as they can. Rapture, if you don't fall over on the ice. Great interest in the target, a sense of bliss. There's a sense that arises in the brain in this practice that of enjoyment, of actually just being in the process of being in a brain, doing this work. Joy, happiness, contentment, tranquility, a slightly softer, rounder, and larger version of rapture. Rapture has a very kind of pointed quality, if you think about it. Joy is a much more open and spacious kind of thought. And singleness, which in the is the unification of awareness. There, in this practice carried to its end, there may be a sort of sense that all of a sudden the brain, as opposed to thinking about 500 things at once or having that underlying sense that 500 things happening, snaps and only one thing is there, that focus of attention at that moment. Why chase this? Well, concentration is the proximate cause of wisdom. Without concentration, one cannot even secure one's own welfare, much less the lofty goal of providing for the welfare of others. So a full establishment of concentration basically allows the wisdom of your own brain, the wisdom of experience, the wisdom of that ineffable whatever universe to arise. That actually doesn't happen without right concentration. And cultivating vipassana, or mindfulness. Even though concentration is important, we have to remember, like everything else in Buddhism, impermanence, things drop away. After you've focused on concentration, you let it go. Because ultimately insight, that really in-depth understanding of the truth of human existence in this particular universe, ultimately insight is the ultimate aim. And insight's nourished by stable, quiet, collected, concentrated states of the brain. And one of the fun things for us over the last 20 years is that this has begun to show up, that actually there is a neuroanatomy of this, and that this is not some woo-woo state by a bunch of ascetic monastics on ecstasy in caves in the Himalayas. This is actually something that exists in every brain in this room under certain conditions. And liberating insight, Nibbana itself, is the fruit of virtue, wisdom, contemplative practice. Even if the ripe apple falls ultimately by grace, its ripening was caused by the watering, feeding, protecting, and shaping of its tree. Meditative practice and concentration makes you accident prone. Enlightenment is the accident of the apple falling on your head. And Shanti Deva's quote here, penetrative insight joined with calm abiding utterly eradicates afflicted states. Concentrative practice taken to the point of penetrative insight joined with equanimity, calm abiding, utterly eradicates the sense of being tortured by one's existence. Another way to think about that. Remember the First Noble Truth, suffering exists. This is probably the shortest statement of the Eightfold Path to eradicate suffering I have seen.
As our son would say, Shanti Deva had game.
Had game. Serious game. And finally, a quote from the Buddha, the heartwood. This spiritual life, and this is also very important to remember in terms of us coming here to teach and you in practice and what to do about this. This spiritual life does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of moral discipline for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. All those will happen along the way, but that is not; those are not the formal benefits. It is this unshakable liberation of mind that is the goal of this spiritual life, its heartwood and its end. Very important to remember, impermanence, impermanence, impermanence. Let go, let go, let go. As Ajahn Chah would say, let go a little grace. Let go a lot, ultimate grace.
That's great. I was just reflecting that it's barely 10 in the morning and we're already in the deep end of the pool. And I think it was okay.
Time for some life preservers.
That's right. And I hope it was okay too. We just decided to go for it, you know. And one of the things that has struck me personally about Buddha Dharma, Buddhist teaching, because that's what we're doing. We're in a Buddhist teaching environment, obviously. The frame for that, as the Buddha himself emphasized again and again in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, ehi pasiko, see for yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's freely offered, see for yourself if it has value for you or not. In that frame then, to speak about the path of Buddhism, what's quite striking to me is that the Buddha was very clear about its benefits in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And it's an entire path, and the whole path is offered to people. So he didn't make a distinction, really, in terms of access to ultimate freedom, ultimate, as he put it, the highest happiness, which is peace, the heartwood, if you will, complete awakening, radical, irrevocable liberation from suffering. And he did not say that was only for the male Brahmin monastics. No, he said it was available to men and women alike. It was available for Brahmins and untouchables alike, the whole range of social classes in India. And it was available to monastics and householders alike.
Got him in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, India. Yeah.
People a lot of people wanted to take him out.
Weren't that happy about that. So the point is, you know, how high is our vision, you know? If we start out in the dusty plains, we may not make it all the way to the tippity-tip-top of Mount Everest, but on the other hand, it's great to have a feeling that the path actually is aimed there. And at any moment in time, the question, of course, is what's the next step to take along that mm-hmm. path? But for me, as he stressed again and again and again, to kind of paraphrase, don't dream small dreams, right? Why not go for it, especially if you can, and enjoy life and be good to others along the way. I think that's my own quick summary of Buddhist teaching. So that said, the stuff that Rick just walked you through fairly briskly, that's like the cliff notes of the cliff notes of the cliff notes of the Dharma. It's kind of like, whoa, okay, let's sort of slow down here, unpack this, let it breathe, and, you know, have a few cupcakes along the way. So to that end, I thought we could get into some practice momentarily and then use this practice as a segue into, as an illustration of material that Rick will get into momentarily about how you can actually activate, how you can actually stimulate the neural substrates of wholesome states of mind, of interest. And by stimulating the neural foundations of the mental states we want to cultivate, by stimulating those neural states, we can gradually strengthen neural structure. So we'll use this practice as a way into that. In a moment, what I'll do with you is do a guided meditation. I personally don't like guided meditations terribly. I'd rather the teacher just shut up. So I apologize in advance for the necessary aspects of offering, you know, pointing out instructions, if you will. Feel very free to just ignore my voice after a while. As we do this practice, which is aimed at steadiness of mind, after laying a bit of a foundation, I'll introduce 7 neurologically informed little things you can do inside your own mind that tend to cultivate steadiness of this combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner of attention, all right? Which did not evolve to be steady. Let's remember that that critters back in the day who are all Zen. Wow. Just absorbed with the light on the water. They got eaten, right? The ones that passed on their genes were like very distractible and nervous and cranky, you know, and we're their great-grandchildren armed with nuclear weapons. All right. So, anyway.
The phrase that I've oftentimes thrown in here is, Om Mani Padme Chomp.
That's right. So, it's helpful to have compassion for oneself. Another theme we'll get into a little later. About that it's not really so natural. I think some people are natural-born saints, you know, they're natural-born yogis. But most of us, myself included, we have to work at it. So it's helpful to me to appreciate that things happen, you know, due to causes. I mean, the Buddhist frame fundamentally is in terms of processes and causes. What are the causes of good ends? What are the causes of bad ends? That's it in a nutshell. So how can we cultivate the causes of good results and decrease the causes of bad results? That's really the essence of Buddhist teaching. So it's very pragmatic. So to that end, in terms of your own mind, momentarily we'll do a practice. I'll make 7 suggestions. We'll see what the results are. Like any practice, we both do something and we run the experiment. A second, we see what happens. So we'll see what happens here. And then we'll do toward the very end of it, 5 minutes of quiet, where we'll just see if you can stay present with each and every breath for 5 minutes in a row, which is no mean feat. Okay, you want to try it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So like any practice, take good care of yourself, as I've said. Feel free to ignore or adapt any of the suggestions from the front of the room. You can see here on the slide the basics of meditation. If you prefer to stand or even lie down, it's really okay. Just try not to disturb others. It's just fine. You can have your eyes open or closed, whatever works for you. You can change it as well, have them closed for a bit and then open them later, it's fine. It helps to sit up with a certain quality of dignity without being uptight about it. You know, the admonitions sometimes or the beginnings sometimes of practice from the Buddha are, oh, nobly born, you know, including nobility in the heart, which is what he really stressed is the locus of the true nobility. Sons and daughters of the Buddha, that's another traditional phrase. So finding a posture that's alert and comfortable, establishing a basic quality of presence, being here, picking an object of attention, a little bit like having an arm resting on a buoy, if you will, in a nice, warm, comfortable tropical sea. Waves of thought come through, waves of sound, waves of sensation, waves of emotion, desire, memory. But you have your arm resting on your buoy as an anchor for you. I'll refer to the anchor of the breath, but feel very free to pick something else. For some people, especially those with a trauma history, the breath or the body are not a good object of attention. So if you prefer to choose a phrase like may beings be happy or may I be at peace or just a word like peace, that's fine. Or an image or a memory. If I'm at the dentist's office, I usually go to Tuolumne Meadows in my mind up in Yosemite Park. So coming to a quality of being here. As you know, there are 2 great ways to engage the mind. We can be with what's there with a quality of accepting, witnessing. And we can also work with the mind. We can encourage the increase of what's wholesome and helpful. We can encourage the decrease of what's not. Both are important. Many meditations only be with the mind. I think that's a very fundamental, foundational practice. And there's a place for working with the mind, what the Buddha called right effort, which is one of the 8 elements of the Noble Path. And so we'll do a combination here of being with what streams through awareness while gently from time to time working with the mind in terms of encouraging helpful qualities of awareness to emerge. So I'll offer 7 suggestions. Each one is a bit of an experiment. The first suggestion, and all of these are aimed at steadiness of mind. The first suggestion is to establish an intention for your practice here, such as the intention for steadiness of mind. Sustaining presence. You can establish an intention top down by giving yourself a little instruction, probably with language inside your mind, like focus or hear. And maybe more importantly, you can establish an intention bottom up by locating or calling to mind or imagining a felt sense in the body that you can give yourself over to that is the embodiment of your intention. Perhaps by imagining or channeling a teacher or someone who is for you an embodiment of this positive intention you have of, let's say, steadiness of mind. So I'll be quiet here as you explore for a bit what it's like to come home into a wholesome intention. Know what it's like to give yourself over to a wholesome will. Then I'll move along to the second intention, and feel free along the way here to stay with anything you want to stay with. In the second suggestion, relax. If we're stressed or tense or agitated, that naturally makes the tension skittery. So see if you can relax the body, perhaps do some long exhalations. Perhaps relaxing your tongue. Relaxing the mind, the heart. Letting go of worry, or drivenness, or heartache. And allowing relaxed well-being, as it does, to pervade the mind. And then letting that second suggestion sort of grow on its own, more in the back of the mind. Now swinging attention to the third suggestion, which is opening to, even inviting, a warm-heartedness. Locating feelings of being cared about and caring. For example, calling to mind someone that you know loves you, wishes you well. The relationship need not be perfect, but fundamentally you matter to this person. It could be a group of people, people in your present or in the past, without struggle, but with some skillfulness, you're simply encouraging or opening to, feeling cared about, which helps the mind calm. And you can also locate your own loving feelings, your own caring, which will also help your mind calm. Then letting that suggestion move to the back of the mind, and now the fourth suggestion. See if you can help yourself feel safer and safer, as safe as you can reasonably be. Being aware of protections around you, this room, sacred ground, good people nearby, also resources in your life, that can help you let go of any unnecessary anxiety. No need for worry, no need for bracing in the body, letting go of any unnecessary guarding or warding off. On the basis of true safety, being able to soften and open. Noticing again and again that you're actually all right, right now. There may also be pain. There may also be concern about someone in the back of the mind. It's all okay. And in this moment, fundamentally, you're all right. And you can let that sink in again and again. Letting any kind of fear or apprehensiveness or anxiety fall out of the mind. Leaving behind a great openness. See if you can register what it's like to notice you're all right now, and to abide one moment at a time, or even for just a moment here and there. What's it like to have a mind without fear coloring it? There may be strength in the mind, there may be appropriate caution or watchfulness, but there need not be any fear. And letting that suggestion move to the back of the mind. Now the fifth suggestion. See if you can find or even encourage some positive emotion. Not struggling. Opening to perhaps a feeling of peacefulness or well-being. Or perhaps something with more energy to it. Something that makes you feel happy. Maybe thinking of something that brings you happiness. Buddha was called the happy one. It's all right to open to and invite some positive emotion, perhaps some gladness or gratitude at being able to practice. Maybe a lovingness, is also a positive emotion. Even if the positive emotion is subtle, it can still pervade the mind. Perhaps a contentment, no wish for this moment to be anything other than what it is, combined with some well-being. So taking a moment to see if you can encourage and actually grow some positive emotion in your awareness. Allowing and encouraging positive emotion to persist in the mind, while moving on also to the last suggestion, which is to get a sense that the benefits of your efforts here, your practice, are sinking into you. They are sifting down into you like water into a sponge, or like a kind of golden dust sifting down into the deeper layers of your psyche, so that you are cultivating, traditional word bhavana, you are cultivating wholesome qualities. You are retaining the fruits of your efforts here so that they have lasting benefit for you. You're taking in the good by sensing and intending that whatever wholesome states of mind you've cultivated here, they're sinking into you to become an inner strength you can take with you wherever you go. That on the basis of these suggestions, and whatever steadiness of mind you've cultivated, in a moment I'll suggest that you stay present with each and every breath for the next 5 minutes, unless you choose a different object of attention. And as Rick said earlier, you can apply your attention to the beginning of each inhalation and the beginning of each exhalation, and then sustain your attention throughout the duration of the inhalation or the exhalation, helping yourself become increasingly absorbed in the physical experience of breathing. It might help to pay attention to the sensations of breathing at one point, such as the upper lip, or to have a more general sense of being a body breathing, abiding as a whole body breathing. If your mind wanders, that's fine, bring it back. You're not trying to suppress thought. You're simply disengaging from them. In effect, for 5 minutes, you're a renunciate, devoted to the breath and renouncing and abandoning all else. Beginning now for the next 5 minutes. The moment we thought we could take a break and to pick up a theme from one of the Spirit Rock teachers, Gil Fronstall, who's been a teacher for me personally, he spoke with me once about meditating through the formal end of a practice, like a runner running through the tape at the finish line of the race, and not just squandering, in a sense, the fruits of our efforts. So as we, in a moment, not quite yet, but in a moment, go into the break, you might see what it's like to shift steadiness of mind from an eyes closed, perhaps, practice on the breath to bathroom meditation, or waiting in line meditation, or chatting with friend, or eating a cookie meditation, or walking in the woods meditation, avoiding tick meditation. So how about in a moment we'll take a 20-minute break, and if you have not yet signed up for CEUs, this would be a good time to do it. You're also welcome to bring tea back in the room. We just ask you to be a little careful of the carpet. And so how about we resume in 22 minutes at 11 o'clock. Okay? See you then. And then we'll talk about what was happening in your brain while you were doing those things with your mind.